is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Outcries growing over the Trump administration's move to drop free admission at national parks on the only two federal holidays honoring Black history, Juneteenth and Martin Luther King Day. Instead, the parks will become free on Donald Trump's birthday, June 14th. In addition, the Interior Department has announced a new fee structure to charge more money for non-U.S. residents to visit the parks and what it's calling, quote, America First entry fee policies. The new move comes months after President Trump signed an executive order titled Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History, which called for the elimination of, quote, divisive race-centered ideology at federal institutions. The Interior Department claims the new changes are part of an effort to make national parks, quote, more accessible, more affordable, and more efficient for the American people, unquote. But not everyone agrees with that assessment. We're joined now by two guests who've spent years trying to make the national parks more accessible. Audrey Peterman is with us. She's been an advocate for national parks for over 30 years, promoting the history of people of color in national parks. She's the recipient of the NPCA Centennial Leadership Award and author of the books Our True Nature, Finding a Zest for Life in the National Park System. She's joining us today from Kingston, Jamaica. And in Burlington, Vermont, Carolyn Finney is a storyteller, author, and cultural geographer who served on the National Parks Advisory Board for 8 years under the Obama administration. She's the author of the book Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship Between African Americans and the Great Outdoors. She's currently a scholar artist in residence in the Franklin Environmental Center at Middlebury College. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Carolyn Finney, let's begin with you. First, your simple response to what has just been announced, that no longer will there be free admission to the national parks on Martin Luther King's birthday and the celebration of the end of slavery, Juneteenth.
Thank you. First, thank you for having me on the show, Amy. And I love how you said simple response, because I don't think there is one. But what I will say is that you can take away the holiday, but you can't erase the truth. And it's not going to change how we feel, not just as Black Americans, but Americans in general, about honoring our history, because our history tells us who we are. So somewhere in my mind, it actually doesn't matter, not in the way that I think he hopes it matters. That's my simple response.
And Audrey and Peterman. Sorry, Juan.
Yeah, and Carolyn, this idea of a president declaring a free admission on his own birthday?
Yeah, you know, I don't like to give it much airtime, you know. It's his prerogative. He is the most powerful leader in the free world. That says more about him. It says actually nothing about us. And I mean us collectively as American citizens. I'm more interested in what it means to try to diminish and dismiss history that's not just Black history, it's American history, and what we all lose when that happens.
So why don't you talk about what you mean by your title, Black Faces, White Spaces?
Yes. What do I mean by that? Well, and the funny part is I came up with that with a white colleague who actually we came up with that title together. I want to make sure that I say that. I was really pointing to when I was interested in looking at national parks in particular, it's because national parks historically were created as a way to represent American identity in the world. We didn't have the old cathedrals of Europe, you know, 400 years ago. But what we had were spaces like the Grand Canyon and Yosemite and the Everglades and Yellowstone. And so when I think about the parks as a place representing American identity is diverse and deep. For me, that's the good and the bad and the ugly of who we are, who we've been, right? And so I was thinking about slavery. I was thinking about Reconstruction. I was thinking about Jim Crow segregation. When I was thinking about Black people in particular, and we could have longer conversations about people of Asian descent and Indigenous people, but thinking about Black people in particular, it was almost ironic that we had created this space representing American identity. But if you had Black skin, your ability to move freely in those spaces was highly limited. And that's really what I was trying to point to. And I was trying to poke the bear of that particular truth of what that means. And it didn't matter that it was a beautiful beach or a beautiful natural surrounding, a forest, a national park, a mountain. It didn't matter. It wasn't just about restaurants and movie theaters. It was any space in this country. And we still have it. It's still present. It's buried deep in some of our legislation. It's buried deep in our cultural mores. It's buried deep in who we are. We still believe certain people shouldn't be living in certain neighborhoods. Certain people shouldn't be landowners. When you look about the history of farming and Black farmers and their inability to get financial support for the work that they were doing. We've been doing this for a very long time. And just because you're out in the natural environment doesn't change that. So I wanted to point to that because the other side of that is the magnificence of those spaces, the beauty of those spaces, the fact that as American citizens, we pay taxes to support those spaces. And I believe we should be doing that. They tell us something about who we are. They tell me something about who I am and the idea that my movement can be limited. And I'm not saying that somebody can say to me, I can't walk into the park, but it's also about behavior. It's also about the way I've been stared at, the way people can feel uncomfortable about you because of the way you look. They know nothing about you, but they make assumptions about you. I want to tell you something else. That book was on a park shelf at some National Park Service Center, and I'm not sure where. And I got an email once, a couple of years ago, from a woman who described herself as Sarah the Great. She described herself as being white, and she said when she saw that book, she removed it and put something else in front of it because and told me to stop being racist. And, you know, I initially got really angry about that. But over time, I've come to really feel some compassion for Sarah the Great. Because I realized Sarah the Great never cracked the cover. I don't talk about or try to diminish the experience of people who identify as white, right? But whiteness is about power, as James Baldwin said. What I'm interested in is making space for all of our stories. And the reality is, I'd love to sit down with Sarah the Great and say, what was it that antagonized you about that? What came up for you? Her response to me said more about her than it did me. And I'm interested in that conversation so we can start to bridge that divide.
Yeah, I'd like to bring Audrey Peterman into the conversation. Audrey, how has the visual propaganda to the American public from Hollywood, from park marketing, from outdoor brands perpetuated this myth that Black people don't belong in the wilderness?
Well, I would say that in building helping to shape the public narrative, that has been true. But in later years, like in the last 5 years or so, that has begun to change because of the assiduous action from people within communities of color striving to change that narrative. Rue Mapp at Outdoor Afro actually has a line of outdoor clothing for people of color. So we've moved a long way from that. But if I might address the question of the president's action, may I?
Yes, surely.
Oh, thank you so much. Because I want to say I love it. I love it. I love it. I think it's the greatest thing he could have done because it is going to backfire spectacularly. For multiple years, people like Dr. Carolyn and I and other Black and brown environmental and national park leaders who are domiciled together at the Diverse Environmental Leaders Speakers Bureau, we have been striving to have this conversation about what the national parks are to America, right? Who gets to enjoy them and the stories they tell, right? And as you can imagine, that conversation has dissipated tremendously since January 20th of this year. And now, lo and behold, We're talking about it because the president aligned himself with racial animus against the national park and an American hero. I think that there are people who didn't even know that Martin Luther King had anything to do with the national park system, you know? But now they do. And there's a common thing, a common parlance that says there's nothing that you can do to make people take greater interest than to have them feel that you're trying to keep something from them. You know, this administration has taken a lot and kept a lot from us. But I think in this actual case with the national parks and fee-free days, we can flood the parks en masse to learn about our history within them. Because the entire history of America, the entire history of every racial and ethnic group in America is in the national park system. And I have traveled from coast to coast. And I'm telling you, once you know that history, you become a totally different person.
The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Nicole Hannah-Jones, the founder of the 1619 Project, wrote on social media, quote, "It might be easy to find things like this merely petty or superficial, but that would be a mistake, demeaning, erasing or eliminating celebrations or acknowledgments of Black America is straight from redemption playbook and is intended to reinforce the racial hierarchy and signal its reinstatement. Today's renaming of military bases for Confederates, reinstalling Confederate statue, denigration of Black holidays, refusal to acknowledge Black contributions while decimating civil rights by an openly white nationalist administration is all to signal the restoration of the racial order," unquote, she said. And I wanted to ask you, Audrey Peterman, data collected from the National Park Service revealed Latinos and Asian Americans made up less than 5% of visitors to U.S. national parks and less than 2% visitors identify themselves as African Americans. Can you talk about the historical context and how you have spent so many decades trying to increase the population of color in the national parks of the United States?
Yes, absolutely. And I completely agree with the quote that you cited. And here's another side to that. We know that the president thrives on making people feel outraged. And I will not give him the benefit of that. I have been to 195 units of the 433 units of the national park system around the country. So I dare say I know this country and feel connected to it in more ways than he does. And or that a lot of other people do. And that's why we have been trying to get the word out, particularly to Americans of color, to say, look, you need to embrace the national parks, get to know about the national parks and visit them in order to see the tremendous historic contributions and legacy that your ancestors have left here. So I think that there's a lot of there's a very false understanding about America and also about the national park system. And I will tell you this: you know that old story about the six blind men who went to see the elephant. They'd heard about this amazing animal, and one fell against its flank and said, "Oh, it's a wall." And the other one felt its trunk and said, "Oh, it's a snake." You know, that is kind of what we're like in America now. And the national park system provides the anatomical material of what our country is. And this is why we've been trying to get the word out for 30 years with ourselves and many other people. But it's, you know, it's a heavy lift to let 150 million people who don't know about the national parks. And when they hear about a national park, they probably only think of that little playground down the street. And they don't know that, you know, Yellowstone can hold New York City 11 times. And Yellowstone has half of all the geysers on Earth. They don't know that the Buffalo Soldiers were the ones who saved the giant sequoias in Sequoia National Park and in Yosemite National Park. There are millions of people from all over the world come to see these 3,000-year-old giants that were alive at the time Jesus walked on Earth. I mean, the national parks have so much to offer every racial and ethnic group and every American. My God, I really think that this conversation that the president has opened by trying to shut out Martin Luther King, trying to shut us out of the holidays, has opened a keg, which I hope will inure to greater awareness among all Americans and greater passion and love for our national cause.
Audrey Peterman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Audrey Peterman has been an advocate for national parks for over 30 years, promoting the history of people of color in national parks, author of the books Our True Nature, Finding a Zest for Life in the National Park System. Carolyn Finney, thank you as well, joining us from Burlington, Vermont, author of Black Faces, White Spaces, Reimagining the Relationship Between African Americans, the Great Outdoors, served on the National Parks Advisory Board for 8 years under the Obama administration, now teaches at Middlebury College in Vermont. Coming up, we get an update on how Mumia Abu-Jamal, the imprisoned journalist and former Black Panther who's been jailed for 44 years, is doing in Pennsylvania. His supporters have marched over 100 miles to his prison to urge the state to provide the medical care he needs to see. Stay with us.
Gonna lay down my sword and shield.
Down by the riverside.
Performing Down by the Riverside in our Firehouse studio years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. One of the world's most well-known political prisoners, Mumia Abu-Jamal, was arrested on this day in 1981 for the murder of Philadelphia police officer Daniel Faulkner, for which Mumia Abu-Jamal has always claimed innocence. Amnesty International and human rights groups have found he was deprived of a fair trial. His lawyers say evidence shows his trial was tainted by judicial bias and police and prosecutorial misconduct, like withholding of evidence, bribing or coercing witnesses to lie. Evidence in boxes discovered in the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office by D.A. Larry Krasner in 2019 includes notes from one of two key witnesses to prosecutors requesting, quote, the money owed to me, unquote. Mumia Abu-Jamal was an award-winning journalist, member of the Philadelphia chapter of the Black Panther Party, ultimately sentenced to death, but went on to write 15 books and record a weekly column while a global movement built around his case. He spent 29 years in solitary confinement. In 2012, Mumia Abu-Jamal was moved from death row to the general prison population after a federal appeals court in 2011 upheld the overturning of his death sentence by a federal judge, citing improper jury instructions, and prosecutors agreed to a life sentence rather than a new sentencing hearing. Mumia Abu-Jamal is now 71 years old, was recently blind for 8 months until he had cataract surgery, but needs more medical care to prevent him from permanently losing his vision. Dozens of his supporters who hope to draw attention to his claims of medical neglect are on a 103-mile, 12-day march that's ending today in Frackville, Pennsylvania, where Mumia is imprisoned at SCI Mahanai.
Taking that long walk, because the walk of freedom is a long walk. And we do it with an intense, extra motivated passion because we just lost a bold freedom fighter in Imam Jamil Abdullah Alameen in the clutches of the state, and that should not have happened. So under no circumstances can we allow the state to take any more of our freedom fighters. It's time to get with me all the health care it needs.
In a minute, we'll speak with someone on the march and a member of Mumia Abu-Jamal's legal team. But first, this is a prison radio commentary that he recorded in August, titled Mumia's Vision, A Message for the Movement.
I have been reluctant to talk about my eye problems. The reasons may have eluded some. But I explained that, you know, in the context of being in prison, any sign of weakness is to be avoided at all costs. These are, unlike many other institutions in society, heavily male and therefore gender conscious in a way that society is not. Weakness brings predation. So I kept it quiet. And I kept it quiet simply because I wrongly believed that once I got examined and once it was clear that this was a real visual contextual problem, that I would get a rather quick response. Boy, was I wrong. I was, as the saying goes, as wrong as two left feet. What I got was evaluation after evaluation after evaluation after evaluation, literally. It was only when I went outside and those prior evaluations were repeated by a noted ophthalmologist that the ball began to roll. And even then, the ball rolled exceedingly slowly. I have been, for all intents and purposes, unable to read, unable to write, unable to see anything more than the masthead of a newspaper and not even its headlines. Blurry television, bursts of color. The television is my radio now.
Mumia Abu-Jamal speaking from prison. SCI State Correctional Institution, Mahanoy, in Pennsylvania. For more, we're joined by Larry Hamm, chair of the People's Organization for Progress, one of the elders on the march for Mumia. He is in Frackville, Pennsylvania, where the prison is, and here in New York, one of Mumia's lawyers, Noel Hanrahan, founder and producer of Prison Radio, which has been recording and distributing Mumia's commentaries from prison since 1992. Larry, let's begin with you. You're on this more than 100 march that's ending today. Why did you march? What are you calling for?
Good morning, Amy. Good morning, Juan. Good morning, Noel. We are marching to free Mumia and free all political prisoners. We are marching to draw attention to Mumia's medical problems, but more importantly, to demand that he get the surgery and medical treatment he needs. We are marching for humane treatment for all prisoners, especially our elders. I'm a witness to the fact that we have an aging prison population. And like Mumia, many of them are not getting the medical care they need. So we're marching today to demand freedom for Mumia and all political prisoners, and to demand that Mumia get the urgent surgery and medical treatment he needs.
And Noel, I'd like to ask you, in terms of his battle for health care, Mumia's battle for health care, why has it been so difficult for him to get that health care?
Health care in this country, and in particular for prisoners, there are contracts by WellPath that specifically state that they limit ophthalmological care in prison to on-site monitoring. They do not send people routinely out for specialist care. We had to fight the Abolitionist Law Center, the lawyers, and the movement had to come together to demand that Mumia get care just for post-cataract surgery. When we got the specialists to look at Mumia, they discovered two other conditions that could mean that he loses his eyesight permanently if he is not treated. He has not been treated for these conditions since June.
So what are you demanding right now?
That Mumia get specialist care for his glaucoma and his diabetic retinopathy, and that he is given the treatment that he deserves. But we're not just calling for Mumia, because there are many inmates. They know who's blind in prison. They are refusing care to save money for WellPath.
Why is ophthalmological care particularly limited?
I don't know if it's particularly limited. It's the one we've researched right now. I believe that they likely limit all care that might cost them money, like our lawsuit for Hep C care in 2017 that won CARE, the first preliminary injunction for Hep C care. They did not treat Mumia with a fast-acting cure for 2 years, causing likely the diabetic retinopathy.
And Noel, Philadelphia has a supposedly progressive DA, District Attorney Krasner, who his own office found forgotten files on Mumia that showed bias in his trial. Why has there been no movement by the DA to reopen this case?
I think the DA has been pressured to actively litigate this case by being impeached by the Pennsylvania Senate, also by being called up in a special, there was a King's Bench petition that deposed Larry that asked him specifically if he was going to prosecute Mumia. There are pressures. Mumia is the third rail in Philadelphia. He is, like everyone else in prison, the 5,000 people that are serving life without possibility of parole just in Pennsylvania. He's one of a class of many. And Krasner, he will do the right thing. He is elected by the people. He's elected by the abolitionist ecosystem. We have an obligation to make it impossible for him to not support us, but there's pressure.
And on what grounds are you asking for his case to be reopened now?
There are three ways that any lifer can get out. It would be a post-conviction relief application, which we are developing, that he doesn't have one in court right now. His last one was denied in March by a lower court that did not fairly review his case. He can also go through the pardon board, which is a 5-member panel, and also the governor. 6 have to be unanimous, or compassionate release, which is extremely limited.
Finally, if you can comment, Larry Hamm, on what you're doing today in front of the prison in Frackville, Pennsylvania, what this more than 100-mile march has meant for you. You're about the same age as Mumia Abu-Jamal.
I am exactly the same age as Mumia, and our birthdays are in the same month. Yesterday, we reached the 100-mile mark, and today we will march the last 3 miles to Mahanoy Prison, where Mumia is incarcerated. We will have a press conference and a rally there to once again make the call for Mumia to get the medical care that he needs, and for all prisoners, especially our elders, to get the medical care
and
that
Noel
they need.
And Noel Hanrahan, 10 seconds.
It's relief from the inside out. This was built by prisoners. It was built by prisoners' families, the Abolitionist Law Center, Salim Holbrook, Brett Grody, the lead attorney. We are going to win and create the world that we deserve.
Noel Hanrahan is one of Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorneys and founder and producer of Prison Radio. Larry Hamm is chair of the People's Organization for Progress on the March for Mumia, speaking to us from Frackville, Pennsylvania, where he is imprisoned. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Hey, are you okay? It's okay not to be okay. That's why Kids Help Phone is available 24/7, 365 days a year, across Canada. So you don't have to deal with your feelings alone. You can text with a trained volunteer crisis responder or call a professional counselor, whatever works best for you. You can also connect with Kids Help Phone through trained interpreters in over 100 languages, and it's always free. Visit kidshelpphone.ca for more info and give your feelings a place to go.